This is Christoph Gesun, and you're listening to Navigating Diversity, where we explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. Our intention at Navigating Diversity is to have open, honest, and informed conversations that can help people navigate some of the most important issues of diversity we're facing globally today. But in a way that isn't afraid to ask some of the big questions, the big, sometimes heavy questions that can bring some of the light and hope into the conversation and help give this and all our lives meaning. At Navigating Diversity, we emphasize three core values. First, recognizing the duality in all things, holding space for both the light and the dark, our differences and our similarities, the things that scare us and the things that make us feel whole, for neither can exist without the other. Second, vulnerability, finding more conscious ways to stand in our truth and help others to stand in theirs, and to share our stories and the most authentic parts of ourselves with the rest of humanity as the only way to heal the world. And third, perhaps our most important value, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's the only way for us to grow and to do better. Navigating Diversity airs on Tuesday nights at 7:30 p.m. on KISU, and you can catch all our conversations at kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity. You can also find us on Facebook. Simply search the handle at Diversity Radio. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by Dr. Arunima Datta, Assistant Professor of History at Idaho State University and historian of South and Southeast Asia and the British Empire. Hi, Dr. Datta.
Hi, Christoph. Thank you for having me. It's an honor and really looking forward to our conversations today.
Thank you so much for being here. So to give some context for the audience, Dr. Datta gave a lecture on gender and sexuality in Hinduism in the first week of February in my History of World Religion class. And I was honestly like mind blown by this lecture. Like, I can't tell you how many of my friends I spoke to and my family members about this lecture, because you brought up information that I always thought about my whole life, but I didn't realize anybody else had thought about it and had done actual research onto this. So you give me a lot of answers to questions I couldn't formulate until your lecture. So thank you for that.
Thank you for making that lecture worthwhile. It's really rewarding to see that students are taking the messages that we deliver through lectures and thinking about it, you know, so insightfully. So thank you.
Yeah, and it's had a huge impact on my life because, as you know, I grew up in an interfaith home. So my mom is Muslim and my dad is Hindu. So I've always held space in my life for both religions, and I suppose now to be exploring the Hindu side a bit more is exciting for me. So you're definitely part of that journey for me to appreciate it. Like, I'm literally wearing Ganesh right now.
Yeah. So actually, that has to be also my favorite Hindu god, I guess.
Really? Ganesh is your favorite?
He's so cute. Yes.
And Ganesh is the remover of obstacles, right?
Yes, and also, like, I think it's connected. So for me, everything is connected through food. So the particular sweets that are offered in Ganesha's name, or pujas, right, festivals, right, is the laddu. And that's my favorite sweet. So I probably made that connection way back in my childhood when I was like, oh, that's the sweet I like. So that's the god I like.
I love that. I love that so much. So let's start a little bit by telling your story. So where are you from? How did you grow up? Kind of what went on in your life to get you to this interview?
Right. And it's a long, long story and a complex story, but I'll try to put it as concisely as I can. So whenever people ask me, where is your home? Where are you really from? You know, those kind of questions that we get asked, it's hard for me to say because as a child, I moved a lot with my parents. So I was born in India, in Calcutta. And when I was about three-ish, if I'm remembering correctly, my parents migrated to California. And so I basically grew up in California for a substantial time of my life. And then my parents moved around again and we went back to India for some time and then again came back and then again went back and then went to Singapore. So it's literally like I see myself as a global citizen, although there is no passport that can say so. Like. So that's my story. And that actually migration history, which was so much very tied to my personal experiences and everything, actually influenced my becoming a migration historian. You know, I have looked at I've followed South and Southeast Asian women migrating to different spaces and their everyday experiences. And of course, an element of that is also their religious experience. So that's kind of my backstory.
Wow. So I think for a lot of us researchers, we do research, right? The research we do tends to investigate our demographics and our stories, our ancestry, absolutely, our intersections.
Absolutely. So my personal experiences literally informed my research interests and it will keep on informing me, I guess. So, yeah.
I love that. So let's walk through some of the highlights from your gender and sexuality lecture, because I felt like so much of it was so profound for me. And I would love for people, particularly in Southeastern Idaho, who have never quite even met a Hindu before or even understand what Hinduism is apart from saying namaste in random situations, right?
Or yoga.
Or yoga. Or lighting incense.
Probably yoga.
Right? Let's give them a good taste into what's really going on. So there are 33 million Hindu gods and goddesses, right? And we know that Hinduism has evolved over time and these gods have changed over time. So how has that process played out?
Yeah, so I guess for us to start that story, we need to understand the backstory, right? Hinduism cannot mean just one thing. Hinduism is a religion that has evolved through the various influences that came into the South Asian region from various other regions, right? From West Asia, from Central Asia, from even the Eurasian part of what we understand as a geopolitical entity today. And as a result, you know, with every wave of migration, we see a new wave of thought, a new wave of gods being incorporated into Hinduism and making it even more expansive and inclusive. Mm. So one of the reasons why I guess Hinduism has survived so long and seen a literal explosion of gods and teachings is basically because of its fluidity. Its ability to adapt. And the 33 million gods and goddesses have two basically reasons for it being so. A, the different waves of migration and influences of other cultures and beliefs on Hinduism. But also, we also need to kind of understand Hinduism in connection with the caste system. And some quote-unquote backward or underprivileged, excluded castes were not privileged to worship the main gods. So their kind of agential act was to create and recreate their own gods. Mm. And as a result, they added on to that whole list of gods and goddesses. That's the second thing. And I should also add the third thing, that when South Asians migrated outside of South Asia, they actually created new gods too, which made the Hinduism or Hindu gods and goddesses list more expansive, because with every change, with every wave of change, right, with every outward migration or inward migration, we see different gods and goddesses being added to that list of worship, along with, you know, the caste factor, wherein gods and goddesses were literally used as carriers of negotiating a voice and agency for certain communities of people who had been excluded or continue to be excluded, right? So that's kind of a long, complex story in short for you.
So it's really interesting because the Hindu gods and goddesses almost reincarnate as society changes and human needs change.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that is one of the key factors that is so interesting in terms about Hinduism, that it's a flexible religion. It has been very fluid and adaptive and responsive to the varying needs of time of different communities. So I think fluidity is the key here that, you know, comes out from all these stories.
So let's talk a little bit about the main gods. This is the Trimurti, or the Hindu Trinity.
The Holy Trinity.
The Holy Trinity. Yes. It exists in Hinduism as well. So let's break down the Trimurti.
So the Trimurti is basically the three male gods. And growing up, actually, I had a question. Why is Trimurti only the men? Why aren't there the women? Which kind of informed later on my research process. But I was struck with the absence of women in the Trimurti. And as you know, the Trimurti gods are Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the person who upholds, protects, right? And Shiva, the destroyer. Now, there is a complex understanding behind Shiva's role in this whole Hinduism, because whenever I tell people that Shiva is basically the god responsible for destruction, they're like struck by, why do you worship a god of destruction, right? And I think there is a very different approach and understanding of the word destruction between the West and the East, right? The West, it's basically about destruction, the end. Whereas in East, especially in Hinduism, we see that time is basically a transient experience, right? It's temporality. So in order to have a new or a more evolved community, society, one or that community needs to go through chaos and destruction of things that don't work. Right? It's almost like talking about, you have a thesis, then you have an antithesis, and then you have a synthesis of the best points of the thesis and the antithesis, right? So destruction is not for, you know, meant in a bad way. Destruction is meant in a good evolutionary way. And that's what we see Hinduism worshiping Shiva through, right? So Shiva becomes the image of a creator, or rather a god who is worshipped so that we witness Hinduism getting the most beneficial thoughts and ideologies from these different realities, contesting realities, and move towards a better reality that is more beneficial for everyone in the society.
So it makes a lot of sense to me, because I think of Brahma, the creator, as birth, and I think of Vishnu, the preserver, as life. And then Shiva is death, right? It kind of captures the three stages of human existence.
Yes. And also we need to remember that in Hinduism, we witness the idea being cherished or kind of worshipped that there is life after birth. There is reincarnation, right? So the death in the form of worshiping Shiva is not necessarily death of the soul, but it is the death of an aspect of the soul which carries on in another form, right? So I think that's where kind of the East-West kind of disconnect happens in terms of looking at death or destruction or chaos.
Mm-hmm. It's a cycle. I think Shiva feeds right back into Brahma, right? Because if we understand duality,
yes,
you can't have creation without destruction. Mm-hmm. You can't have destruction without creation.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So let's talk now about the goddesses. So the main gods, the Trimurti, all men. Let's talk about some of the female goddesses like Kali and Durga. In your lecture, you kind of pitted Kali against Durga and talked about how they were portrayed in such different ways, which I found so cool.
So, again, a very long story. I could sit here talk about it all day long. But so Kali and Durga are, you know, portrayed, understood as different sides or different shades of feminine power in Hinduism, right? But if you look at where they converge, they actually converge in defeating the bad, defeating the wrong. So in their goal, they are pretty much the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
But their means to the goal sometimes vary, right? And Durga is basically the goddess who evolves from the confluence of Shakti or power given to an entity by Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, right? So in many forms, and this is where Hinduism blows my mind, because in some scriptures, Durga is the wife of Shiva, but in other scriptures, it's not very clear, but it's basically, it can also be read as a daughter of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, right? Mm-hmm. So, and we need to understand the fact that Hinduism is also interpreted in different ways, depending on the linguistic communities, depending on the regional communities, even within South Asia, right? Like Durga's depiction or form or the idol worship that we witness in the north of India is very different from the image of Durga we see being worshipped in east or even south of India. So there are those variations, and the mythologies following those variations are very different. So I am just kind of explaining one aspect of it. So it's Mahishasur is the devil who basically goes on, this is the backstory of Durga Puja, right? Who goes on creating havoc and oppression, exploitation in the world. And Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva are individually unable to contain him. And so they basically agree to bring all their forces together in the form of Durga, a female goddess takes birth, who is the only one, the chosen one, to slay this demon. And she is the goddess with 10 hands because she is kind of carrying all the powers given to her, bestowed out on her by all the male gods, right? And finally, she does kill, she slays the demon, and again, peace and goodness is restored in the world. So the story goes. But behind Durga Puja is also this kind of negotiation of women in Hindu communities who, you know, Hinduism is a patriarchal society like any other patriarchal society in the world, right? And what women through Durga Puja started doing is basically 10 days of Durga Puja, right? The festival of Durga Puja. They created this narrative around it that the goddess Durga is actually married to Shiva and has these children, Ganesh, Karthik, Lakshmi, Saraswati, and she travels home to her parents' house, right? And gets this whole 10 days of relief, quote unquote, relief from being a home manager or being a wife, right? And she is given all the privileges of being back home. She doesn't work at all. It's like celebrating daughters, that whole 10 days. And so in a you need to think it in terms of the patriarchal context where this is happening, because that becomes a significant, a visible break, an episodic break from a longer term of, you know, suppression or exploitation. And that doesn't need to be a theatrical exploitation of domestic violence, but it's an oppression of women's voice, women's choice, which we see getting privileged and appreciated and celebrated through the process of Durga Puja, right? So I guess that's something very interesting and important that we see through the Durga Puja. And also, in fact, the Durga Puja is also very, if you are bringing history into the present, Durga Puja becomes this whole event where all female related products, jewelry, sell in great quantities, right? So all the capitalists in our market, the consumerism in our market begins to tap into that idea of this is a season of celebrating women power. So gift your wives, gift your daughters, gift your sisters, these things. So it becomes a present day consumerism kind of tool also for the capitalists. In terms of Kali, so interestingly, right after Durga Puja comes the Kali Puja within a few weeks. And it's interesting because in many scriptures, in many mythological stories, Kali is just another figure, another bodily adaptation of Durga. And so Durga is more like a calm warrior, whereas Kali is a portrayal of a woman power who has had enough with all the evils and patriarchal issues in the community and starts taking action against it. And so becomes this untamable warrior woman who is, you know, just the opposite of Durga. She is very violent. She goes on a killing spree. Unlike Durga, who was focused on killing just one person and was very calm in her expression and the war, the records show that, right? The mythological records. Kali basically goes on this killing spree of any individual male individuals who are seen doing anything wrong. And the reason or other religious historians say that this was also an attack on patriarchy is because if you look closely at Kali, right, she is a semi-nude figure. So it's a voice against everything that women had to be shaped in, put into, and imagined. The second thing is, if you look closely into that figure, she's wearing a garland of beheaded heads, right? Men's heads. They are all male heads. There is no female head. So in various ways, it has been interpreted as, you know, this rise of women power against patriarchal suppression and exploitation. However, there is a problematic depiction of Kali too, because she stops and she basically, the image that we see of her is her tongue is out, like, oops, I did it, right? That kind of expression. And that comes from her stepping on her husband's body. And that kind of reverses the whole patriarchal discussions that we have about Kali, because if she is going against patriarchy, why would stepping on her husband's body be such a shocking event? So in that sense, it kind of shows that subconsciously even going against the evil in the society or the patriarchal evil in the society, Kali is still kind of tied to patriarchal notions of worshiping the husband. And, you know, in Hinduism, if your foot touches an elderly person or any male member elder to you, especially your parents or your father or your husband, that's like a no-no, right? I wouldn't say it's a sin, but it's a no-no, and you have to express your respect. And that coming out of the tongue is basically an expression of that. So in many ways, again, Durga and Kali are very similar. Their ends are very comparable. There are nice overlaps, but I guess their means to the end, the images they take in popular visual culture is very different. And also kind of, if you look at the color of Durga and the color of Kali is very different, right? Kali is usually blue or black, kind of signifying the darkness in female power, whereas Durga is fair and white, right? And portraying that kind of calmness.
So you also mentioned the concept of Shakti. So is Shakti associated with the divine feminine energy in Hinduism?
Yeah, it's very much closely associated with the divine energy. And, you know, much like French, the Eastern languages, especially Hindi or, you know, in Sanskrit, you'll see a lot of words have, I mean, most of the words have feminine or masculine, you know, identities, right? So Shakti is a feminine word for power. So Shakti, of course, means power and energy, and it is woven into the scriptures of Hinduism as a word that signifies the victory of good over bad. But it also stands for the divine feminine strength. And in fact, in many scriptures, you will see Durga having the term Shakti associated with her, right? And if you go towards the Eastern regional discussions of Durga and Kali, you will see Shakti being used interchangeably for Kali and Durga. So in that sense, it is basically hinting towards the feminine power in all of Hinduism.
Wow. And I would say we need a little more Shakti in the whole world right now.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's a great place for us to end part one of our conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Datta.
Thank you, Christoph.
This is Christoph Kassoon, and you've been listening to Navigating Diversity. Join us next week at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday as we continue to explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. For more information on all episodes, visit kisu.org/programs/navigatingdiversity or find us on Facebook. Simply search the handle @diversityradio.